The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So this evening, I'd like to have this part of the evening go a little different than usual. What I'd like to do is to hear a little bit your thoughts, your concerns, in the form of questions you might have. And maybe I'll respond. But I would like you to prepare for some questions rather than just ask in the usual way you might ask. And if you'd be willing, you don't have to, you could sit quietly and just wait for this part to go over, but if you'd be willing, form groups of four or five and discuss a number of possible questions that you might ask someone like me on an evening like tonight. And you can bring some questions up. You have different ones. If you have different things, maybe some can be quite personal, some can be not so personal, maybe more about Buddhism or whatever seems pertinent or alive for you or significant for you. And discuss, you know, have a little discussion about those questions, and then kind of explore them a little bit and why you're interested in those questions and why they're important for you. And then as a group of four or five, see if you can somehow, in a loving, caring way for each other, decide on one of them that you might ask. So maybe you can refine them, maybe you find some synthesis, maybe you find some new question that kind of subsumes all of the questions you have as a little group. So that's the exercise. And we'll do that for about 5 or so minutes. I'll ring the bell when I think time is over. And then we'll hear some of those questions, and if it seems appropriate, I'll respond. Now, as a background for this little exercise, the capacity to ask questions and to have questions in the Dharma, in this practice, is really important. Your ability to ask good questions, to refine your questions, helps you to see clearly. Helps you to see a new perspective. And if you're going to become your own teacher, which is kind of the goal of this practice, one of the ways towards that is to learn how to become a skilled questioner. And so you don't have to necessarily ask someone else your questions, but if you can kind of spend time in your life considering what questions you have about practice, about your life, refine them, work on them, kind of dig underneath them, clarify them. Sometimes you'll find all kinds of wonderful answers. If not answers, new perspectives on what's going on. It's a whole art, this whole thing about asking questions. And very, very useful for this path that we're on here. So you'll exercise that skill here for a few minutes, and then we'll see what we do with it when we reform and we hear some of the questions. We'll see how that unfolds from there. So hopefully that's okay with you, and if you would please form little groups of maybe 4 and 5, and then we'll see what comes up. I'm used to a monastic life where there's a clear response from a bell. So before we hear from some of you the questions that maybe you came up with, what was it like? I'd like to hear, what was it like to do that process? What was it like to share your questions, discuss them, and try to come up with something that difficult? Sure. You thought it was better tonight?
Better than I expected.
Oh, better than you expected? No.
Put on the spot.
Uh-huh. So it was really good. It didn't feel like you were on the spot by just kind of exploring it, discussing it with a group.
Well, just sharing other people's questions. Uh-huh. And it's important to ask questions even though I prefer to avoid them.
Nice. Maybe we can use the mic next. But a few more comments.
It was creative. I thought that it was creative.
So it was creative?
Yeah.
Great.
Everybody commented, and it evolved into one succinct question. It was
great.
A nice process.
Forward to hearing it in a few minutes.
Yeah.
I noticed in talking about the question and trying to come up with it to be more succinct, the answers to it came.
Mm.
So it kind of, the question almost dissolved as it got clearer.
Fantastic. Yeah. You won't need people like me then.
Hi, so I am relatively new, so I had a lot more questions than everybody else.
Uh-huh.
And because I've been exploring a lot more, I've been reading a lot and trying to understand. So for me, it had a different realm, if you will.
Different what?
A different aspect uh-huh. to this, because I have quite a few questions.
Uh-huh. That you want answers for.
Pardon me?
Yes, that makes sense. Yes, that's great to have questions. If you're new to all this, the more questions, the better. Great, thank you. Okay, so maybe we can hear some of those questions. That if there were some of your groups, if you were able to come up with one that you agreed on or something that came out of that discussion. I'd love to hear some.
Okay, so being the new guy, so I've been practicing some meditations, and I've been reading that there are different kinds of meditations, and you should practice them in different ways.
Uh-huh.
So there's, the loving kindness meditation, and there's a calming meditation, and I just read somewhere or heard, from a YouTube talk that there's a process to these meditative practices. The first thing is to calm yourself and then go, start loving yourself and then pass it over to everybody else.
Uh-huh.
So I'm not sure whether that's the way to approach this.
Uh-huh.
And that's my question.
Great. So the question is, you heard a technique. You learned about a technique, and you're wondering if that technique is a good way to go. So you're questioning the teaching, and hopefully in a healthy way, and maybe looking under the surface and the assumptions behind it, the purpose of it. So all kinds of interesting questions to go along with that. What's the purpose of the technique, and do you understand really the technique well? How it's taught? What are the underlying what's the context for doing it, and what situations is it really useful to do that, and what situations is it not useful to do that? So there's all kinds of series of questions that are really good to ask from the one you're starting with. It's great. Thank you. So let's hear some other ones.
Hi. My son and I had a question, and it had to do with the teachings were all, a lot of them are written by people who have the luxury of being enclosed in a supportive space as they're writing these works. And we were wondering about room for emotions, including anger, rage, sadness, when you're meditating. And tell me if I got most of it right.
Yeah, it's just, is there room for emotions in meditation and kind of Zen Buddhism in general?
Uh-huh, great. So, but I didn't first have the question that the teachings were written by people who...
the luxury of being in a supportive environment. And we're in this cocoon here, but after this cocoon is over, we go out to the outside world.
I see. Here, I see. It's kind of more calm and not so exciting. And
it's very exciting. It's kind of calming.
Nice. Well, if you go to monasteries and many practice centers where people live and in this cocoon and all that, it turns out that often they're a little bit like hospitals, whereas the people who really have big need for help go there more than. And so we often find people with a lot bigger range of emotional life, and they're trying to deal with it and cope with it and using the practice for that. So that's a great question about the relevance of this, and with you know, a rich emotional life, some of the great extremes we have, one of the things I've learned is that this sitting in meditation, what looks like it's calm from the outside, sit still, is one of the best places to give complete freedom to your emotions. So it's one of the best places to let rage roar through you, because you're not going to hurt anyone. And you can kind of get out of the way in a safe way. Sitting still, you don't act on it. Sitting still, you're not kind of getting involved in it, but you're also not repressing it. You let it course through you, and then you can learn from it. And there's all this inner wisdom that can operate that's in our system. There's self-healing processes that goes on. So it's quite something to be able to have the skill to sit quietly and look like you're calm, but inside you know you're not. You learn a lot about yourself and find your way through it. It's a great thing.
We were having that debate, which is back and forth, which is you suppress the anger because you're calm, you're in a calm state. So he and I were both having a debate about that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I hope it's not suppression. I hope it's not suppression, but rather it's kind of sitting still and allowing it. So we have more questions.
We have a question.
Yes.
Can you hear? So the question is around how do I deal with integrating a more structured practice with the sort of relaxed practice that we have, that I feel that we have here. And I find that I'm still struggling a little bit with the unstructured part of it, so maybe I'm getting a little lazy and I'm more accustomed to more structure as an example. If we have a Dharma teacher, we get up and the Dharma teacher always leaves first, but I don't see that happening very consistently, and for some reason it bothers me. Little things like that, but I'm finding that there's a little disconnect for me.
I see. So a variety of things here. So there's the relationship between being relaxed and at ease in this practice and at the same time being disciplined. And some people have a struggle finding, because both can exist. But if you're too relaxed and not disciplined, you're not going to go anywhere. But if you're too disciplined with no relaxation, that's going to be a problem too. And then the question about the container, the way a group comes together, the customs it has, the form it takes, the rituals it has, can be supportive for a focused mind, a settled mind, for the practice. And so there's various kind of formalities that can go on in some Buddhist centers. And you mentioned one of them, the teacher gets up first. And that's what happens at our retreat center, right? So that has a nice feeling and present. And here, I'm sometimes the last one to get up. And so there's advantages one way, and there's strengths and weaknesses one way, strength and weaknesses another way. And everything has strengths and weaknesses. And so we have to kind of, part of answering that kind of question would be to look at the different strengths and weaknesses of the different approaches, and then look at the context and see in the big picture which is useful in any given context. So that's not a real answer, but it's a response.
Thank you.
Our group had lots of great questions, and they didn't really boil down to one succinct question, but I got tasked with trying to pose something. So thank you. So the question revolves around the importance and the best ways to ask for and receive guidance from more experienced meditators, from teachers or people who are more advanced, the importance of doing that, the opportunities for doing that here at IMC, and then some of the kinds of questions that arose in that connection were how to resolve a tension between a commitment to ethical practice and being non-judgmental about transgressions, mm-hmm. and questions about how to introduce other people, perhaps other family members, to meditation. And so there were a range of things around, but the central thing was about getting guidance from more experienced teachers.
It's a great question. I mean, it's a great to have that concern, and how to get guidance, how to get support. And you asked about, you know, people have maybe more experience, more senior practitioners. I think it doesn't have to be necessarily people who have a lot more experience from you, but sometimes getting a range of, ask people their experience around these things, and ask a range of people, what's your experience with this topic, or this concern, or this way? And then you hear different answers, and some of them might be a good fit for you, and you might learn different things from different people. So I think it's really nice to have questions, to have community, have people to ask in. And it comes alive in a very different way than if you just read books to try to get answers in books, because it's something, it's someone who's really grappling with it or has experience that they have to report back. And the reason to talk to many people is that there are many appropriate answers. And for you, there might be different appropriate answers on different weeks, months, years, you know, depending on your circumstances. So just talk. So simplest answer to you would be just talk to people. Just find people to talk to. And then.
So our group is on. Yeah. You can hear. It's like a two-part question. One is like a general, do religions end up at the same goal, like we were talking about, love, compassion? If we were going on different religious paths, would we all end up to the same space? That's part one.
Yeah.
Part two is the confusion between like having a guide or a mentor or a practice versus becoming one's own teacher. So the trap of like a self-centered ego versus like dependency on a guru.
Right. Great. So, the first question, I think, deserves more questions of its own. It's appropriate to question them further, that they shouldn't just be taken at face value, but to go deeper and say, you know, why am I asking the question? Why is this an important question? What am I trying to accomplish, what am I bumping up against? What's the problem that I'm trying to address in asking that question for the first one? So I would stay with it and ask questions of the question. Don't take it for granted. Go deeper and find out what's going on. And the second one, I'm wondering just how I remember you said it, now it's already a memory, is I wonder if you're setting it up, the question, in two absolute terms, you know, and so the idea of a guru that you kind of listen to too much, you know, versus being your own teacher, maybe it's not one or the other. Maybe there's a nice hybrid that goes in between there, where we don't put a teacher up on a pedestal, and you know, like they all knowing, but they're a guide. They're supportive. They can offer ideas. They offer perspectives that then you can engage with. And certainly it's important to be your own teacher, but you don't want to do too much of that. You want to get input from outside, from other practitioners, from friends, from teachers, get challenged sometimes, get new perspectives. And so you hold it all kind of in an open way, in a relaxed way, but it's a fluid way where you can go back and forth and learn from all these areas. And when we allow ourselves to be changed, willing to allow ourselves to take in what other people say, not blindly, but we have this willingness, and that goes a long way to minimize self-centeredness. But if we kind of learn to rely on ourselves some, that goes a long way from being blindly listening to other people. So it needs both, I think. Thank you.
Hi, we had a question over in the back.
Yeah.
We were talking about the Four Noble Truths and the concept of desire leads to suffering. To remove suffering, you must remove desire. And we've learned from the talks that it's not really about this idea of desire, but it's the idea of an attachment or craving to that desire. But still, it was hard for us to figure out kind of the nuances of what that means. And so, for instance, someone in our group had this example where she had always wanted to have kids. This was a strong desire for her. So the idea of removing that desire was pretty much impossible. Mm-hmm. But so is it more that she should be not attached to this desire, as in to not care if she doesn't have kids? How should she be thinking about this, or how? What's this nuance between desires and then this idea of attachments and cravings?
So I think that's a very good question. It's a reasonable question, well thought out and well articulated. So I appreciate it a lot. And perhaps the starting point is the wrong place. The starting point, I'm not sure where your starting point is for the question, but if you know, one interpretation for it is that the starting point was hearing teachings from this Buddhism thing. Buddhism says Four Noble Truths. And therefore now I have to deal with it. You know, Buddhism is this great world religion, it has all the answers, and it says the Four Noble Truths, and now I have to deal with this teaching. Another approach would be have a different starting point. And the starting point, one place to start is in one's own experience. And start with your suffering. And then if you start with your suffering, then you study it. And you see, what's going on when I suffer? What's happening here? And to kind of try to tease apart the different pieces and know it well. And then the teachings of the Four Noble Truths might be just like a little pointer and say, here, look at this. Is there any, when you suffer, is there any desire as part of that suffering? When you suffer, is any attachment or clinging as part of it? And what's the relationship between your suffering and that clinging? And or that desire? And is it okay to suffer? Because a desire is so important? Or is there a way of having a desire without the suffering part of it? So it becomes a much more of a personal exploration, that a starting point is, what's going on in here with me? And maybe the outside teaching kind of is a little bit, helps with the questioning, helps with looking and finding out. And I think that's more the spirit of Buddhism, is to start with oneself and start with one's suffering and kind of find one's way with it. And part of the reason we try to get calm and centered is to say it in a provocative way, so we can suffer better. Not because we're supposed to suffer better, but suffer better so more clearly. Suffer more clearly so we can really start seeing what's happening there. Because if we're not calm, it's hard, difficult to see clearly. So is that an okay answer or response? Or
yeah. Thank you.
What do you think was relevant?
Oh, very.
Okay,
yeah.
Great.
Thank you.
So a theme that emerged in our group is a deep concern with the violence, both actual and verbal, kind of permeating our culture and other cultures right now. And we're wondering about a skillful response to that, particularly to the judgment that can come up when I engage or someone engages with the culture, and the heartbreak of seeing Buddhism or practice co-opted into these kind of systems of violence.
I think that you made the question kind of too big.
Okay, then pick any part that sounds good to you.
Too many pieces, you know. But the judgment thing, I think if judging or judgments are problematic, then they have a root. And then rather than dealing with the judgments, you have to get underneath them what the root is. And a common root when people are distressed with what goes on in society and have judgments about it a common root is fear. And it's really important to be able to get down to the bottom of the fear and really come to contend with that and work through it and understand it. And then there's other roots for, you know, there is a lot of violence in the world and difficulty in the world. And, you know, that was true in the time of the Buddha, and it's true periodically through history. And not periodically, mostly. And so there's heartbreak. And so part of, I think a wise life is not a life that doesn't experience heartbreak, but a life that is wise about the heartbreak. Because if we don't know how to be wise about a broken heart, then the broken heart spills out in all kinds of dysfunctional attitudes and relationships and responses and judgments and lashing out and running away and all kinds of things. But to learn, again, here, this wonderful skill of sitting still, learn to sit quiet and open like this, and looks like you're calm. It's also a powerful place to learn to be at ease with a broken heart, with the pain of the world. Sometimes we sit here with the pain of the world, the suffering of the world. But we learn how to be with it in a way that is not reactive. And we don't close down, we don't, you know, contract. And then I hope that broken heart becomes a very important, it's kind of like the door, the broken heart means that the door is open in the heart. And you know, you want to have an open door heart. And so then if from that pain of a broken heart, there's a lot of wisdom and a lot of compassion and a lot of action that can come out of it. But the action is wiser if we've learned how to be wise. Action is much more effective and wiser, I believe, if we have a really good, wise relationship to that, the sorrow that we feel, what goes on in the world. And if we don't have that, if we get angry, if we get inappropriately afraid, if we get depressed, if we get, you know, we take it too personally, if we, all kinds of things go on, then it doesn't help anyone. But if we can learn, see, I'll end with this. the word in the ancient Buddhist language for the word world is loka. And when the Buddha used the word loka, he had two meanings for it. One meaning was the world out there, like the way we talk, the world, you know, when we talk, we kind of wave outside and we apply everything outside the door or something, the world. And then the other meaning of world, loka, is it's the world of our individual experience. It's the world that arises from the center here of us. It's the world of our experience. And we're the center, the locus of this world of experience. It radiates from us. And in fact, it looks like more often than not, when the Buddha used the word world, he really kept pointing back to the world of our experience. And the world of our experience is the world that we have choice over. The world of our experience is what we can have the most of, find our, you know, be wisest about and adjust and change and find our way with, do something with. It's hard to change the world as a whole. Certainly it's good to try sometimes. But we can do something with the world of our experience. And so both are true, that we can, both kinds of worlds are true. Both are important. But we never, in Buddhism, you never want to sacrifice, or give up or give away or destroy the goodness and the welfare and the freedom and the ease that's possible in the world of our experience, the world that emanates from our capacity to experience things. There's no authority in the world that says that you have to give up your freedom, give up your own welfare, give up your own sense of being at ease in this world of experience that we have. And it turns out that this world of experience If that is well taken care of, and we can have a deep sense of freedom and ease here and maintain that, not lose that by fear and anger and judgments and all these things, that's one of the most important building blocks for the world, the rest of the world. And so the question, so one of the, I think, profound questions is, what world do you want to live in? You make your world into a hell. You make your world into a heaven. Which world do you want to live in? You have a choice in the world of your experience. And if your world of your experience is well tended to, and you do the do something like spiritual practice, it really kind of develops it in a good, healthy way, then it's portable, and you can carry it, with you into places where the world outside is having a tremendous difficulty. But you can respond and deal with those difficulties, and hopefully do it with great enthusiasm and with a sense of justice and all kinds of things. But there's no need to sacrifice this inner, the world of experience, for what's going on out there. And so so the Buddha, kind of, I think, you know, over and over and over again, kept pointing back to the world of experience, which begins here, begins in your heart, begins here in your mind. And that's what we really need to take care of well. And then, through our wisdom and compassion, hopefully we will become people who offer alternatives to the violence in the world, that are concerned with trying to change it and stop it. But there's no need to feel distress. So the absence of distress, because if there's distress, you've created a you've created hell for yourself. And so it's a challenging teaching. It's a difficult way to say. It's difficult to say. Some people live in hell, in the wider world, and to say to them that they should take care of their own world of their own experience is kind of putting worse than salt in the wound, and you're telling them to do something which may be impossible for them to do. But for the people who, do have the ability, the good fortune, to be able to do something like this meditation practice, that's where, for those people, we can begin clarifying and working through and changing ourselves in such a way that we can become, hopefully, agents of change for a world that needs people who are peacemakers, who are fighters for justice, who are caretakers and nurses and doctors for this, all the different forms of suffering in our world. So in terms of, you know, the judgments, we keep looking for the roots in ourselves, and then we go in, and then we get turned inside out, and then we can go back out into the world. Well, I would have loved to heard more of your questions, and I apologize if I responded too much to some of them, so we didn't hear more. But I think one of the most important things I was hoping would happen this evening is that by having that little discussion and exploration of questions with your friends here, that the whole to reinforce or to inspire the tremendous value in asking questions. And don't settle for the first question, but question the question and go underneath and keep opening it up and exploring it. And you can learn a lot on your own if you become a skilled questioner. But if you don't question, if you don't develop your ability to question and investigate that way, and you're always depending on the books or always depending on the teachers, then you probably will never understand how to transform this inner world of experience. It needs you. It needs your engagement in this. So questions is one of the ways to find our way through that. So, thank you.